It boils down to the paradox that life requires stability and instability at the same time. Life also requires that vastly different timescales, from nanoseconds to millions of years, somehow be tied together. A cell operates in thousands of a second, but took tens of millions of years to evolve. The meshing of opposites that makes life possible isn't theoretical. Inside a cell, some atoms and molecules must be freed up to do various jobs by bonding with other atoms and molecules. Yet, having done their job, stable substances must persist without ever changing. But which atom goes where? They don't come with address labels. To compound the problem, some of the most important organic chemicals, chiefly chlorophyll in plants, and hemoglobin in red-blooded animals, carry the tricky balance of stability versus instability to amazing extremes. Hemoglobin sits inside a red blood cell, constituting 96% of the cell's dry weight. Its function is to pick up oxygen and transport it through the bloodstream to every cell in the body. Blood gains its red color from the iron in hemoglobin, which turns red after it picks up an oxygen atom, exactly as iron turns reddish when it rusts, and for the same reason. When the oxygen atoms reach their destination and are released, the red color fades, which is why blood in your veins is bluish. Venous blood is on the return journey to the lungs, where it will start the process of oxygen transport all over again. The ability of hemoglobin to carry oxygen is 70 times greater than if the oxygen were simply dissolved in the blood. All vertebrates contain hemoglobin, except fish, who pick up oxygen from water through their gills instead of breathing air, and therefore employ a different process. As a molecule, hemoglobin is a miracle of construction. Since we've gone through the looking glass, let's imagine walking into the hemoglobin molecule as if entering a vaulted building like a greenhouse with spidery chains of smaller molecules forming the girders and beams. At first, it would be hard to even see the iron atoms that are the whole reason for hemoglobin's existence. Ribbons of proteins form helixes, and other chemicals link the helixes, functioning like welded bolts. With an eye for pattern, we discern that the protein chains hold a specific shape. There are subunits within the units or proteins, each bonded to the only thing that isn't a protein, the iron atoms formed into hemes. These are rings of proteins encircling the iron. In structural terms, there are also specific folds and pockets that need to be in place. Think of rich people living in huge mansions that, rationally speaking, are a waste of space for one or two people to rattle around in. The hemoglobin molecule is built from 10,000 atoms, creating a vast space that exists so that exactly four iron atoms can pick up four oxygen atoms for transport. These 10,000 atoms aren't some kind of luxurious waste, however. They are recombinations of simpler proteins, also necessary for the life of cells. Besides containing hydrogen, nitrogen, carbon, and sulfur, the structure of hemoglobin contains oxygen. So the actual task that faced inorganic matter billions of years ago on planet Earth was as follows. Oxygen had to be set free into the atmosphere without getting gobbled up by greedy atoms and molecules around it. At the same time, some of the oxygen had to be gobbled up to form complex organic chemicals. Those organic chemicals had to be structured into proteins, of which hemoglobin is one of the most complex. Hemoglobin had to be arranged internally so that it encased four iron atoms, which are absent from hundreds of other proteins, including those that resemble hemoglobin in their working parts. The iron atoms couldn't be inertly encased, like locking diamonds up in a safety deposit box. The iron had to be charged as a positive ion, so that it could pick up oxygen atoms. But it wasn't permitted to steal any of the oxygen already being used to build proteins. Finally, the machinery necessary for constructing all of the organic chemicals had to remember how to do it the next time, and the next, and the next, while other nanomachines sitting nearby in the cell had to remember hundreds of different chemical processes without interfering with the machine that makes hemoglobin. Meanwhile, in the nucleus of the cell, DNA has to remember and put into motion with precise timing the whole enterprise. No matter how you cut it, this is a lot to ask of atoms, whose natural behavior is to bond instantaneously to the atom next door and stay that way. And this natural behavior hasn't gone out of fashion. The countless sextillions of atoms in stars, nebulae, and galaxies are acting as they always have. So are the atoms contained in the solar system, the sun, and our planet, aside from the atoms in living creatures. Those atoms manage the trick of behaving naturally while at the same time pursuing a creative sideline, namely, life. As animal life was humming along creating hemoglobin, natural processes on the vegetable side of the operation created chlorophyll, which sustains plant life along a different route, photosynthesis. We won't conduct a tour of the chlorophyll molecule, except to say that it consists of 137 atoms, whose sole purpose is to encase one atom of magnesium rather than the iron in hemoglobin. This ionized magnesium atom, when it comes into contact with sunlight, allows carbon and water to form a very simple carbohydrate. How photons of light from the sun can create this new product opens up new mysteries. But once the simplest carbohydrate molecule was generated by plant leaves, an evolutionary breakthrough was made. The machinery that manufactures chlorophyll took a separate track from the machinery that manufactures hemoglobin, which is why cows eat grass instead of being grass. Note, in photosynthesis, chlorophyll only needs the carbon atom and carbon dioxide, releasing the oxygen atom into the air. You may say, aha, that's where the free oxygen comes from that isn't stolen by other atoms. But unfortunately, chlorophyll needs a cell to live inside, and that cell required free oxygen for its construction before chlorophyll could start to operate. Now we have a context for asking the right question. The mystery of how life first began comes down to the transition from lifeless chemical reactions to living ones. Is life simply a sideline of universal chemical behavior throughout creation? Any answer will also have to include why only some atoms and molecules engage in this sideline, while the rest continue on their merry way. The journey from small to nothing at all. It turns out that getting around "life comes from life" is no easy feat. Absolute beginnings don't seem to exist, but the urge to go smaller and smaller is irresistible to scientists. The oldest living things were microscopic in size, much smaller than cells, which didn't evolve until hundreds of millions of years later. The most recent finds indicate that 3.5 billion years ago, only a billion years after Earth was formed, complex microbial life had already taken hold. There may be fossils of bacteria detectable in very old rocks, as some microbiologists believe. But every time one is discovered and dated, it gets challenged. It's extremely difficult to know if you're looking at a fossil or the traces of a crystal. Perhaps the secret lies at a level even smaller than bacteria and viruses. So we could knock on the door of molecular biology, the field that has revealed everything we covered about hemoglobin and chlorophyll. The scientist who answers the door would only shake his head if we ask where life came from. The organic chemicals I study already exist in living things, he says. No one knows where they originated. Chemicals don't leave fossils. We could remind him that evidence of amino acids has been found on meteorites. Other people speculate that life may have existed on Mars before it evolved here on Earth. If a big enough asteroid hit Mars, it could have blown chunks of rocks into space. And if one of those arrived on Earth, and the life sticking to it survived the journey through outer space, maybe that's how organic chemicals began here. Our molecular biologist offers a dismissive remark as he shuts the door. These kinds of speculations are closer to science fiction than science. They have no evidence to back them up. Sorry. And so it goes, like a bad dream in which an endless corridor leads to one door after another, endlessly. No matter how small you reduce the problem, there is always a smaller level, until the whole thing, matter, energy, time, and space, vanishes into the quantum vacuum and leaves us with a very frustrating situation. Because there has to be an answer. After all, life is here, all around us. The journey from living things that takes us to nothing must be reversible. Life comes from life. Doesn't let us off the hook for explaining how, to begin with, life entered the picture. In a curious and very clever way, one of the originators of the multiverse, physicist André Linde, uses nothing to show why human life must have come about. When asked about the most important recent discovery in physics, Linde picked vacuum energy. This is the finding that empty space contains a very tiny amount of energy. We've touched upon this fact, but Linde works it into the reason for life on Earth. At first glance, the amount of vacuum energy looks quite trivial. Each cubic centimeter of empty interstellar space contains about 10 to the negative 29 grams of invisible matter, or, equivalently, vacuum energy, Linde points out. In other words, invisible matter and vacuum energy are fairly comparable. This is almost nothing, 29 orders of magnitude smaller than the mass of matter in a cubic centimeter of water, 5 orders of magnitude smaller than the proton. If the whole Earth would be made of such matter, it would weigh less than a gram. The importance of vacuum energy, tiny as it is, was vast. The balance between the energy in empty space and the invisible matter in empty space gave us the universe we inhabit. Too much of one or the other, and the universe would either have collapsed upon itself soon after the Big Bang, or would have flown apart into random atoms that never gathered into stars and galaxies. Here is where Linde finds the key to life on Earth. Vacuum energy isn't constant, he believes. As the universe expands, the density of matter will thin out as galaxies fly farther and farther apart. As this happens, the density of vacuum energy will also change. Somehow, human beings happen to live at the perfect point of balance, and we must live there. We sprang up, life sprang up, at a place that has to exist. Why? Because as vacuum energy is tipping the scales one way or the other, all possible values come about. One might imagine a family's home movies of the kids growing up. Most of the movies got lost accidentally, but there's footage of one baby being born and then the same child at age 12. Even with missing footage, it must be true that every stage of growth between one day and 12 years existed. Linde's origin story for life on Earth is the best that anyone has to offer, he says, and the story takes an optimistic turn. According to this scenario, all vacuums of our type are not stable, but metastable. This means that in a distant future, our vacuum is going to decay, destroying life as we know it in our part of the universe, while recreating it over and over again in other parts of the world. Sadly, there's a fly in the ointment. Metastable means that areas of instability get canceled out if you stand far enough back. The carbon inside a dying person's body is just as stable as the carbon in the body of a newborn baby. Standing back, nothing counts that happened between birth and death. That's fine for chemistry class, but useless in real life. The vacuum state is stable as galaxies are born and die, or as the human race emerges and then meets extinction. This says nothing about where life came from, only that the stage was set for it. Linda does an elegant job of setting the stage, perhaps the most elegant job anyone has done so far. But he doesn't take us from nothing to the origin of life. Are quanta alive? The multiverse hasn't really solved the mystery of life, and there's a better clue, which relates to ordinary energy, like heat and light, rather than the exotic species of vacuum energy. The behavior of ordinary energy is to even out, so when energy starts to clump up, it immediately tries to escape the clump and reach a flat state. That's why a house where the furnace goes out in winter gets colder and colder, until it's the same temperature inside and outside. The heat evened out. This dissipation of energy is known as entropy, and all life forms resist it. Life consists of energy clumps that do not even out until the moment of death. When you wait for the bus in winter, unlike a house where the furnace burned out, your body remains warm. This isn't because you are well insulated by wearing a thick coat against the cold. Instead, your body extracts heat energy from food and stores it at a constant temperature, around 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Every school child is taught this fact, but if we knew how organisms first hit upon the trick of defying entropy, that might be why life exists in the first place. Almost all the free energy available for life on our planet comes from photosynthesis. Besides needing their own supply of energy to grow, plants are at the bottom of the food chain for all animal life on land. When sunlight hits cells that contain chlorophyll, the energy in the sunlight is harvested.